From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, a political memoir that turns into an erotic memoir, we talk with John Updike about his 15th novel, Memories of the Ford Administration. Lynn Nofziger has written a real political memoir about his years as a press secretary and political advisor to Ronald Reagan. We'll get his assessment of the Republican Party today and the split between the conservative and moderate factions. And TV critic David Bianculli reviews some of the latest attempts by the candidates to use TV to their advantage and previews some of their upcoming appearances. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Bush took his campaign to Macomb County, Michigan today, an area that's home to conservative Democrats who voted Republican in the last five elections. Don Gagne reports.
The Bush campaign is visibly buoyed by new polls showing the race narrowing. That was clear in Michigan Governor John Engler's introduction of the president this afternoon at a rally at Macomb Community College.
The momentum is shifted. It's in the president's favor now.
For his part, President Bush hammered away at familiar themes, saying Bill Clinton can't be trusted to be president and that he'll raise taxes on the middle class. He also attacked Democratic vice presidential nominee Al Gore, who favors higher mileage standards for automobiles.
Hey, listen, you think you're going to save General Motors by slapping more regulation on them? Less regulation, less taxes. Bring that back.
Michigan has 18 electoral votes. Both Republicans and Democrats consider the state crucial to a victory nationwide next week. For National Public Radio, this is Don Gagne in Detroit.
A group of House and Senate members filed a federal lawsuit today that challenges the constitutionality of a cost of living increase in their own pay. The lawmakers are due for a 3.2% cost of living adjustment that would raise their pay from more than $129,000 to almost $134,000. The suit claims the increase violates a constitutional amendment written by James Madison in 1789, but ratified only this year. That amendment, the 27th, prohibits Congress from raising its pay unless an election takes place first. Israeli officials say that for the first time, Jordan has officially expressed its willingness to sign a peace treaty with Israel. They say the statement comes in a joint Jordanian-Israeli document drafted in Washington. NPR's Linda Gradstein reports from Jerusalem.
The document is an agreement on the agenda for negotiations between Israel and Jordan. It was concluded as the current round of Middle East peace talks recessed until after the U.S. presidential election and must still be approved by the Israeli Prime Minister and the Jordanian King. Israeli officials say it is the first time that any Arab state except Egypt has used the word peace treaty in an official document. An Israeli foreign ministry official said the joint agenda was the only substantive achievement so far from the Madrid Peace Conference exactly 1 year ago. He said the document had five sections and that Israel expected the Jordanians to begin the negotiations with the issue of water. There was no timetable set for how long the talks between Israel and Jordan will last. I'm Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
Stock prices closed slightly lower today after a session of mixed trading in which investors played cautiously as they waited for developments in the election campaign. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 5 points to close at 3,246. This is NPR News. Bill Clinton campaigned today in the Midwest, deriding President Bush's claims that the U.S. economy is strong. In Toledo, Ohio, the Democratic challenger blamed what he called the passivity and complacency of the Bush presidency for the loss of 1.4 million manufacturing jobs since 1988. In New York City, the young man accused of stabbing a Hasidic Jew to death during riots last year in the Crown Heights section of Brooklyn was found not guilty. NPR's Maria Hinojosa reports.
The jury found 17-year-old Lemerick Nelson not guilty of all counts in the stabbing death of Yanko Rosenbaum, a 28-year-old Australian rabbinical student. Rosenbaum was killed in apparent retaliation for the accidental death of a 7-year-old black boy, Gavin Cato, who was run over by a Hasidic driver in August of last year. The boy's death sparked several nights of violent confrontations between black and Hasidic Jews in Crown Heights. The district attorney in the case argued there was overwhelming evidence against Lemerick Nelson, including a confession made to police. But the defense said Nelson was innocent of the crime and pointed to several inconsistencies in police testimony. The jury, made up of 6 blacks, 4 Latinos, and 2 whites, deliberated for 4 days. Outside the Brooklyn courthouse, police tried to control several hundred people from the Hasidic community who were angrily protesting the verdict. This is Maria Hinojosa reporting.
The biggest share of the wealth generated during the 1980s went to those who were already the richest of the rich, according to a study released today. The study found that the top one-half of 1% of the nation's richest families collected 55% of the total increase in household wealth between 1983 and 1989. It also reported that while the richest Americans got richer, the bottom 60% of families made no progress or actually lost wealth by 1989. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. I look forward to a new book by John Updike for a couple of reasons. One, of course, is that I want to read it. The other is that it gives me an occasion to invite him back for an interview. John Updike has a new novel I quite enjoyed called Memories of the Ford Administration. It's his first novel since the conclusion of his Rabbit series. Memories of the Ford Administration sounds like it should be a political memoir. Its publication date is Election Day, but it's not exactly what you'd expect. I'll let Updike explain the conceit of the novel.
Well, a professor of history at a New Hampshire college called Wayward College has been invited by a mythical organization called the New England, what is it called? Northern New England Association of American Historians. It's trying to get out a special issue on the Ford administration, and it requests his memories and impressions of the presidential administration of Gerald R. Ford for a written symposium on same to be published in their tri-quarterly journal Retrospect or Retrospect. And my hero, Alf Clayton, obliges of his memories, but they tend to be personal. He was in a state of considerable erotic déshabille at the time, having left one wife and not quite latched on to the next. And also he begins to include more and more of a book he was trying to complete at the time about the 15th American president, James Buchanan, so that the book is alternates chapters of Alf's life during the mid-70s with Buchanan's total life focusing on the pre-Civil War administration. He was president from 1857 to 1861.
Why does this book, which seems like it will be a political memoir, really end up being a book about the sexual and family crises of one person in one specific period?
Well, because the Ford administration was a high watermark of sorts, or so I construe it, of the sexual revolution. It was pre-AIDS. The freedom had been established and was almost old hat. And the counter-revolution of the microbes hadn't occurred yet. So people were fairly sexy, and there was this general sexual seeking going on under Ford, as I keep saying, for which Jerry Ford, by the way, should not be blamed, although...
I'm sure he's blushing, though.
I wonder. I hope it's not
how he thought of his administration.
No, and nor how we thought of it at the time. But looking back, it was a moment, a kind of a paradise that won't come soon again.
You are really wonderful at using sex to describe character, and it's not the first novel you've done this with, but let me ask you why you, especially in this novel, use sex to describe character.
I suppose one of my youthful theories when I was a beginning writer was that sexual behavior, like other behavior, was characteristic, and that the 19th century tradition of closing the bedroom door did shut us out from some revelations into how people behave, because people don't behave the same in bed as they do at the dining table. I don't know, and I guess it's a fairly deep self that declares itself in sex, and for that reason of interest to any novelist, I would imagine.
Let me ask you to read a passage that I think will kind of get a little bit at what we're talking about here. And this passage has several things. It's about sex and character. It's also, this whole book is the memoir, do you know what I mean, that this character is writing
right.
for this historical society. Well, most, yeah.
Shall I try to begin this,
this
long passage? Alf has set himself up, this is me talking, by the way, not writing, in an apartment about a mile from the college where he teaches, and he has visitors. One of them is Wendy Wadley, who is a faculty wife, but not his wife. Let's begin. In the sudden shades down gloom, Wendy, suppressing her natural tendency to chatter, rapidly undressed down to her white underwear, which glowed like the soft strips of daylight below the canvas shade's brown hems. I did the same, mirroring her semi-abandon, keeping on my underpants for now, as if hesitating to unbandage a flaming wound. The ornate etiquette of screwing a woman for the first time. Does the lady expect a condom? Should one offer the use of the bathroom and use it oneself as before an extended auto trip? Are there any surface blemishes or peculiarities to be explained, lest they give alarm, or should we let the flesh speak for itself? The awkwardness takes us back to childhood, when one knows no accepted forms. In this abrupt closeness, a subtle but immensely actual novelty, in odor, in texture, in erotic slant, and an estimated experience and expectation, looms like an intimidating cliff. Though I had held Wendy in my arms at many a college dance, and in the groping latter stages of many a faculty get-together, when the host, to prolong the already distended evening, fishes out a forgotten Billy Eckstein LP, her body was basically strange to me. Her skin, the broad patch of it between her bra and panties, felt cooler than I had expected, and harder in its curves, especially the adjacent two of her prominent rump. I allowed myself the unprecedented liberty of caressing these through the silken sheath of her underpants, more bikini than I was accustomed to. It was considerate and perhaps cunning of Wendy to keep her underwear on. As a woman of my generation, she understood, as an undergraduate would not have, my need to be sheltered from too blindingly sudden an exposure to the glories of the female body. And the stimulus that underwear would be for me, with my long gradualist history of forbidden glimpses up a skirt or through a blouse armhole, and of backseat grapplings with resistant elastics and snaps. Or, why make a maneuver of it? She herself felt shy, and her sense of etiquette dictated reserving to a later stage of our session removal by trembling hands working in partnership of these last garments. For though this was 1974, we had not been born to its freedoms, but brought to them through the timidity and taboos of earlier eras.
I really like in the passage that you've just read the way you get at the conflict between the freedom and the self-consciousness of that era.
Well, I suppose of any era, in a way, sleeping with somebody has never been simple, and not even in the Ford era was it simple. And also, I was struck reading it, the reference to earlier eras, after all, that these people were born in the 30s. They had some taste of Depression America, of wartime America, of a Puritan America, really, so that for them, these liberties and this sexual ease could not be taken for granted, as it presumably is by the undergraduates whom you mentioned, who were born in the 50s, I suppose.
Were there writers who you had read when you were coming of age who did what you were trying to do, or did you feel like you were exploring new territory?
Well, I was trying to take advantage of a frontier that had really been opened up. I can't claim to be the first adventurer on these frontiers of sexual explicitness, of sexual realism, as I like to think of it. Parts of Ulysses, for one, including the famous Molly Bloom soliloquy, showed me what sex should be in a book. It should be in there and should be bluntly and really and hotly there, but at the same time should be embedded in a lot of other reality that isn't sexual. I had read that. I read Henry Miller. I read Lady Chatterley, of course, and I read Lolita by Nabokov, all of which came out in the late 50s, early 60s, so that by the time I wrote Rabbit Run, the promised land of total sexual explicitness was there, but I wasn't quite ready to enter it and did have a little trouble with that text, but no text since.
What changed for you?
I think the world changed in that what was daring in Rabbit Run within five years had become quite tame. Couples, which came out in 68, was a much more explicit book, and there was no question of running it the way I'd written it. I think the point had been won that a writer is entitled to describe what is, whether what is sex or going to the bathroom or bank accounts or anything else. That is, the human experience should be fully available to the writer of fiction.
I'm glad you brought up going to the bathroom, because there's usually a bathroom near the bedroom in which the partners in your new novel are having a sexual encounter. And I really like the way you do that, since, I don't know, in a lot of more romanticized or descriptions of sexuality, that bathroom would never be there, if you know what I mean. It's a kind of part of reality that you're bringing into it.
Bathrooms do tend to be next to bedrooms,
right.
And bathrooms are very important in our lives, and we shouldn't omit them. You know, I'm reminded when I was young and impressionable, there's a Hemingway novel called The Have and Have Not, in which one character, a female character, accuses a male character, "You taught me that sex is what hangs behind the bathroom door." And that always stuck in my mind, I think, and reminds me that sex is a kind of plumbing, and that sex and plumbing are very closely allied.
I want to quote a couple of things that you write in this book. You write, "Everything was out of the closet, every taboo broken, and still God kept his back turned, refusing to set limits." And you write, "The Ford era was a time of post-apocalyptic letdown, of terrifying permissiveness." Do you think freedom makes a lot of people nervous?
Oh, yes. Kierkegaard called it dreadful freedom, and it is dreadful. There was something very cozy about the limits that society placed upon sex, and we all miss them to a degree. And, of course, some are coming back. I think that the sexual liberty was frightening, because there went with it a kind of there was no longer the freedom to be unsexy. We all had to get with it, those of us of a certain age, at least. There was a general feeling that there was a great deal of sexual treasure out there being exploited by entrepreneurs, and that anybody with any savvy at all should be getting on the bandwagon. So in a way, it was a bit of a drag, I think, maybe for men and women both, more for women perhaps than for men.
If you're just joining us, my guest is John Updike. His new novel is called Memories of the Ford Administration. Two of the themes that have really preoccupied you in your fiction are sexuality, but also spirituality, God, questions of religion. So it's both the carnal and the spiritual. Do you see that as a contradiction, or do the two like come together for you in revealing like two different sides of human nature or whatever?
Yeah, I would say so. I would say that the life force is quite keenly felt in the sex drive, and also in the drive toward immortality, which is what takes people to church by and large, that these kinds of ecstasy offer some grounds for supposing that we are immensely important, that we're not just little two-legged bugs occupying the earth for a few decades, but are, there's something momentous, that there is, in fact, a spiritual dimension to our lives, and sex is one doorway into that room, and religion another.
I want to get back to the era of the 70s and the late 60s for a moment. It was primarily like the baby boom generation who was at the forefront of the sexual changes of that period. You have been writing about that, and you've also kind of experienced it on some level, although you were slightly older than the generation at the center of that. And I wonder if you felt at all envious of younger people, or disturbed by them or whatever, being somewhat on the cusp?
Yeah, I don't feel envious now. I'm not sure what I felt in the 60s. It is true that my generation, the 50s, who were young in the 50s, and in my case in the mid-50s, I was 21 and 53, were relatively tame and repressed. At the same time, repression creates energy and excitement. We didn't have to. We didn't have the terrible hangover that the 60s generation did either. And enough of the counterculture, enough of the sexual movement, drifted upward into the older ages that I by no means felt deprived. In a way, my generation was lucky. A man in my Harvard class, Ted Hoagland, said that we were the best situated to enjoy the changes of the last 50 years because we still had a kind of innocence when we began, and yet we were young enough to be deflowered, as it were, by the revolution.
My guest is John Updike. His new novel is called Memories of the Ford Administration. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is John Updike, and he has a new novel called Memories of the Ford Administration. It wasn't until I read this new novel that I knew that that I found out that you had written a book about James Buchanan yourself. I think of you as somebody who's, in a lot of ways, chronicled your times through fiction. What made you want to go back and write history?
Well, maybe a feeling that I'd chronicled enough of my own little generation, and a writer is always looking for the next book and trying to explore his own frontiers to a certain, as much as he can. The historical novel has many troubles with it, especially for a realist writer as I claim to be. The fact that you can't exactly know what people said or what things tasted like or what rooms were like is to me a great barrier, and that's why the first Buchanan book was a play. But after all, the past is embedded in the present. It's all around us, in the buildings and our memories and our parents and our grandparents. I had grandparents that lived to be quite old, so I had a good sense of time reaching back. So in a way, Buchanan was just at the far edge of my possible experience. There was something about him that spoke to me and seemed in a way personal.
I've been meaning to ask you something about writing metaphors or analogies. You use them when you use them so well. I'll just read an example of one that I just kind of particularly like. This is an example from your new novel of, your main character is making love for the first time to the mother of one of his former students. And he says about her, "She bestowed herself upon me with the amused efficiency of a suburban mother laying out a big tray of peanut butter and jelly sandwiches for her children and their playmates on a Saturday afternoon." Now, does something like that just come to you, or do you sit down and try out five or six of them and kind of carefully construct it? I know for myself, like, I'm the kind of person who does not think in analogies. They do not come to me. And so I'm just curious if this is something that you work on, or if it just...
It kind of just comes, yeah. Actually. And when it doesn't come, you should try to do without the metaphor.
Right.
I've been writing so long, I have a kind of inner rhythm now that dictates when the metaphor is going to come. And maybe it's not a good thing. I mean, I keep trying to shake myself up as a writer. I early read Proust in English, and he is the great creator of metaphors and of linking two unlike things in this magical way. So I suppose that's the influence of Proust. Two unlike things that mutually illuminate each other is the idea of a metaphor, and by and large, it's like dialogue. You kind of listen for it, and if it comes, you write it down, and if not, you move on.
Now, is this the kind of thing that only comes when you're writing, or do you kind of drift through the world seeing these analogies as they happen?
I don't really see them much, I don't think. In fact, I see rather little as I go through life. It's only when I sit down at the desk that I become a writer and a seer in any sense. I occasionally think of plot developments when I'm in the car walking along, but the actual texture of the writing you more or less have to do while you're there. It's a kind of a music, and you have to be into it, and then it begins to happen and chime, and who knows where it comes from.
We last spoke on the air right after the announcement was made that Tina Brown was going to be the new editor of The New Yorker magazine. You've had several pieces in there since then, a couple of fiction pieces, a review of Camille Paglia's new collection of essays. How does the new New Yorker feel to you so far?
It's been very hospitable to me, as you say, and she's been very flattering and kind, and I've always loved The New Yorker and will intend to contribute as long as they want me. Since I grew up on the format of the Sean era, it doesn't do much for me to see the names at the top and the type bigger and so on. But if it opens it up somehow for younger readers, I don't see that it does any essential harm. That is, the words are still the same. And the old New Yorker, in many ways, seems to survive under the new New Yorker. I think, to her credit, she's trying to do a very hard job of pouring old wine into a new bottle without spilling too much of the old wine. The magazine seems to be livelier in a way, and all those little jumpy sections she's added now perhaps make it easier to get into. The New Yorker used to come to the house and you'd look at it and read the poems. This is me. Read the poems and the book review and then put it down, waiting when you had an hour to really look at it. And now the magazine kind of invites you in 5-minute snatches, and maybe that's the way we read now.
It's been, a couple of years now since Rabbit died in your last Rabbit novel. How does it feel now to have that much distance on the character?
Well, I'm a little sorry that he fell so ill. He doesn't quite die in the novel, but he certainly seems to be dying. And he was, as I said at the time, he was very good to me, and I hated to do it to him. I did feel like he was a kind of a brother, and I was giving him a lot of hard knocks. But life is like that. I am God, as far as those characters go, and God gives us hard knocks, so why should I spare Rabbit his own hard knocks? I think it was the right way to wind up those four novels. He was a man who was going to die early somehow, as ex-athletes often do somehow. If you've peaked at 18, I think it's hard to keep rolling happily until you're 80, although some people do it. I miss him in a funny, faint way, but he is only a character, let's not remember. I'm still here, and I'm still trying to write.
I want to get back to something we were talking about earlier, what you described as the theistic outlook. In talking about the freedom of the sexual freedom of the 70s, and talking about how you've written about both sex and religion, I'm wondering if you ever in your life experienced great feelings of kind of like religious guilt over new behavior, or great kind of religious confusion as times got more free about what was the appropriate way to behave.
Yeah, I probably have. I feel sort of guilty all the time, actually, so it's hard to pick out any peaks of guilt. But the bad thing about sexual freedom is that it shakes up existing arrangements, and there are a lot of innocent bystanders, or we call them innocent. I mean, who's innocent? But relatively innocent bystanders who get shaken up in a sexual rearrangement. So that, I think, is where I felt guilty whenever I was asking anybody to make allowances or to change houses. Or a writer is somebody who's, a writer. This writer is, you know, afraid to intercede too boldly in the fabric of what is. You would rather write about it and manipulate it in that way than actually go out and change things and challenge people and upset houses. So yes, any time the sex slopped over into the real world, I felt badly.
John Updike, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
John Updike's new novel is called Memories of the Ford Administration. It's published by Knopf. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, the state of the Republican Party from the perspective of a longtime aide to Ronald Reagan. We talk with Lynn Nofziger, who worked as Reagan's political advisor and press secretary. He has a new political memoir. Also, TV critic David Bianculli looks at the presidential candidates' unprecedented use of television in this campaign. And David previews some of their appearances still to come. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Both President Bush and Governor Clinton have been campaigning in the Midwest today. Mr. Bush campaigned all day in Michigan, a state he says he must win to assure his reelection. In Macomb County in Grand Rapids, Mr. Bush attacked his opponent, saying Clinton is counting on a bad economy to ease him into the White House. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
These guys are weeping tears, Mr. Bush said today. It's bad news for Clinton and Gore that we're not in a deep recession. At the Henry Ford Museum in Macomb County and again at the Gerald Ford Museum in Grand Rapids, Mr. Bush trumpeted favorable economic news and then urged Americans to cast their ballots next Tuesday after considering Governor Clinton's, quote, pattern of deception.
The choice before the American people is a vast difference on experience, philosophy, and yes, character. Character matters.
The president was introduced in Grand Rapids by former President Gerald Ford, who warned the crowd that Mr. Bush's opponent, a Democratic governor from the South, bore a strong and frightening resemblance to another Democratic governor from the South, Jimmy Carter. I'm Elizabeth Arnold in Grand Rapids.
Also campaigning today in Michigan, Democratic presidential contender Bill Clinton accused President Bush of waging a campaign of fear, and said that Democrats offered the nation a time for hope and for change. Clinton told a rally today in Detroit that the country can do better and should go forward together in solving its problems. Clinton charged President Bush with saying anything in order to win votes and offering nothing except failed trickle-down economics. In South Africa, the government says it will double the number of army troops in Natal in a bid to curb political violence there. At least 50 people have died in the region this week. NPR's Ann Cooper reports from Johannesburg.
The deployment of additional troops was one of several measures announced by President F.W. de Klerk after 2 days of top-level government meetings on the crisis in Natal. De Klerk said additional police will also be sent to the region, and more parts of Natal will be declared unrest areas, giving security forces greater authority to search buildings and detain suspects. The latest killings mark an escalation of an 8-year-old battle between the African National Congress and the predominantly Zulu Inkatha Freedom Party, whose political base lies within the Natal region. De Klerk and other South African officials have called for an urgent peace summit of Inkatha and ANC leaders, but so far neither side has moved to try to schedule such a meeting. I'm Ann Cooper in Johannesburg.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down more than 5 points to close at 3,246.27 on volume of more than 206 million shares. This is NPR News. In Texas, where there is an early voting system, officials say more than 660,000 people have cast their ballots for president. This is more than double the number for the advanced turnout at this point 4 years ago. Under the previous absentee ballot system in the state, there had to be an excuse for voters to go to the polls before Election Day. A spokesman for the Texas Secretary of State says in one county alone, turnout is up almost 300% on a daily basis. An election season flurry of anti-pollution initiatives from the Environmental Protection Agency continues to create controversy. Today, an EPA plan to limit chemical industry emissions was attacked by environmental groups and local air pollution officials. NPR's John Nielsen reports.
The EPA proposes to cut air emissions of more than 140 toxic chemicals, mostly by ordering the chemical industry to put new pollution control equipment in their plants. The result could be reductions of more than 522,000 tons a year, mostly in states like Texas, Louisiana, and New Jersey. But environmental groups and local air pollution control officials say the plan is full of loopholes. The biggest, they say, allows factories to weigh the costs of compliance against probable risks to human health. Each day this week, the Environmental Protection Agency has issued regulations designed to carry out the Clean Air Act of 1990. Critics say the announcements are timed to help get President Bush re-elected. The EPA says it's trying to meet court-imposed deadlines for implementation of the act. In Washington, I'm John Nielsen.
Republican House candidate Michael Huffington has set a spending record for a House seat. So far, he has spent more than $4.75 million, most of it his own money. Huffington, who is running in the Santa Barbara area, has inherited money from his family's oil, gas, and real estate concern in Texas. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Yesterday, Ronald Reagan said he would campaign in several states for George Bush. My guest, Lynn Nofziger, was one of Reagan's closest aides. We've invited him to share his perspective of the campaign and the Republican Party. Nofziger worked with Reagan on and off since Reagan's first run for governor of California in 1966. He was Reagan's press secretary for that first campaign and for his first presidential campaign. Then Nofziger became Reagan's political advisor. During Nofziger's political career, he also worked for the Nixon administration and the Republican National Committee. When he left the Reagan administration, he became a lobbyist, but he was convicted on ethics violations. The conviction was reversed on appeal, but it pretty well destroyed his business. Now he has a new memoir called Nofziger. He's not George Bush's biggest fan, but I wanted to know if Nofziger still wants Bush to win.
Oh, yes, I do. I'm going to vote for him. I'm going to urge all my nutty friends who want to vote for Ross Perot to vote for him. And I think that if you have to make a choice, that I really don't have another choice.
Are you encouraged by the tightening polls, and what do you make of them?
Yeah, I'm encouraged by them. I think one of the reasons is that George Bush finally began to campaign. He hadn't been working very hard at this. He seemed kind of dull. It was almost as if he didn't care. Now it sounds like he cares. That's number one. Number two, I think the fact that maybe some of the attacks on Bill Clinton about his draft record and so forth are finally beginning to get through to people. After all, it's after the World Series. And thirdly, I think that Ross Perot himself hurt himself with his attacks on the Republicans and claiming he got out of the race because they were going to disrupt his daughter's wedding. What nonsense.
I saw you on Nightline, I guess it was about a couple of weeks ago, mm-hmm. when George Bush wasn't doing this well in the polls, and you were talking about how the Republicans were suffering in part because they had turned away the Reaganites when the Reagan people offered their help to the Bush campaign.
True.
Are you someone who was turned away?
Oh, yeah, but I'm one of many. I wasn't turned away, I was just ignored. You know, I know most of these people. I told them time after time, tell me what you want me to do. They didn't want me to do anything. They just didn't respond. But that's just not me. It's people like Ed Rollins. It's people like Paul Laxalt. It's people like Margaret Heckler. A lot of people who could have been helpful, and all they want to do is see a Republican reelected.
Why do you think you were turned away?
Because I worked for Ronald Reagan, because Bush people, for reasons that I have never been able to figure out, kind of don't like us Reagan people. Maybe we're too conservative for them, or maybe it's just because we beat him in 1980.
At the Republican convention, there was a lot of talk about family values, and Buchanan did his culture war thing. Mm. Then the Republicans seemed to drop that. It didn't seem to play very well. Would you have encouraged them to pursue the family values and the culture war line?
I think I'd have done it in a little different way. One of the things that disappointed me was that apparently they backed poor old Dan Quayle off on the Murphy Brown thing. I thought he was on the right track, but then when he starts sending this make-believe baby toys and sits with single mothers to watch the first episode, it just looked to me like they'd been scared off. And I think there are many things about family values that go way beyond whether or not you've got a single mother. But I look at this country, and I'm concerned about juvenile delinquency, about crime, about kids using guns, and about pornography that is now legitimate and sells for $50 a copy in the good bookstores. I am concerned about the growth of illegitimate children, the numbers of illegitimate children. I'm concerned about using abortion as a method of birth control. So there are a lot of things out there that relate to my way of thinking to family values that I think a lot of Americans are concerned about, and I don't think we've touched on them.
You know, when I was watching you on Nightline, I was thinking about how unusual it was to see Republicans fighting among themselves or quarreling with the party on TV. That's usually the Democrats' job.
We sound just like Democrats, don't we?
Yeah, yeah. So did you have reservations about doing that?
Oh, I haven't enjoyed particularly attacking George Bush.
Did you say you have or have not?
No, I have not.
Oh, okay.
Or pointed out pointing out what's going wrong. But I think in many ways it's been important that we talk about these things, because how are you going to right the problems, R-I-G-H-T, if George Bush and his people refuse to admit there are problems? And these are things you have to address.
Last night, Ronald Reagan announced that he would campaign in several states for George Bush. Mm-hmm. Did he ask you for your advice about that?
Oh, no, but if he had, I'd have said, go out and give him hell, Ronnie. Campaign hard. There's a lot at stake here.
What kind of shape is he in now? He's 81 years old.
Well, he's in good health from everything that I've been able to see, and talking to people who see him much more frequently than I do. He's always exercised regularly. He loves to go up to that ranch and cut brush and ride his horses and stuff. So he's in good shape. One of the things with Ronald Reagan is he needs to be active mentally, too. If he is, if there's not something out there to challenge him, he kind of relaxes and doesn't do very well. And so I hope if he gets out in his campaign, it'll kind of give him a little pizzazz, and we'll see him out there being really effective.
In your book, you write that George Bush has dashed whatever hopes many of us had that he would carry on the Reagan legacy. What did you want him to do that he hasn't done?
Well, I would have liked to have seen him not sign that tax bill. I would have liked to have seen him just generally more conservative. I was a little disappointed in him signing that civil rights bill, which is still pretty much a quotas bill, whether you want to admit it or not, and other things. I think the thing that has disappointed a lot of us is that George Bush never talked about Ronald Reagan up until very recently, never gave him much credit for any of the things that went right with this country, such as the demise of the Soviet Empire, which I think history is going to largely credit to Ronald Reagan. He talked, 4 years ago about a kinder, gentler nation, as if Ronald Reagan had somehow or other given us a nation that was neither kind nor gentle. This sort of thing, just as if he were trying to divorce himself from Reagan, rather than saying, hey, Reagan is a guy who gave us 8 years of prosperity. Reagan is a man who stood up to the evil empire, confronted it, and forced it to back down, and eventually forced it out of existence. Just the feeling that George Bush was kind of glad to get rid of Ronald Reagan.
What kind of conflict do you perceive going on now within the Republican Party between the conservatives and the moderates?
Oh, we'll see a lot of conflict come beginning November 4th. If whether George Bush wins or loses, because there's going to be a new fight for the soul of the Republican Party. And you're going to see people on one side like Jack Kemp and Bill Bennett and Phil Graham and Pete DuPont and one or two others, and you're going to see liberals out there like Pete Wilson, the governor of California, George Voinovich, the governor of Ohio. Then there's going to be a real hassle during the next couple of years, I think, to see which way this party goes.
My guest is Lynn Nofziger. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Just joining us, my guest is Lynn Nofziger, and he was involved with Reagan from 1966 to 1985, serving as press secretary and political advisor. In your memoir, Nofziger, you write that, you know, you used to try to keep Reagan from the press.
Yeah.
How would you feel if he had to go on Larry King now and do town meetings?
Oh, I would like that very much. Ronald Reagan is very good at those sorts of things if he does them frequently. And one of the things we did when he first became governor of California is have a press conference every week. And that way he was on top of the issues, and he was kind of on top of his game. What happened to him when he became president is the people around him didn't have any confidence in him, so they kept him away from the press. Now, me, we're talking about a campaign, which is a different matter from sitting in the Oval Office or the governor's office. In a campaign, you try to keep the campaign focused on certain things. And if you let your candidate, any candidate, answer all the silly questions that the press asks, then they changed the focus of the campaign for you, and that's hurtful to the campaign, and that's why we tried to keep him away.
You didn't try to keep him away because of the gaffes that he would make? That
oh, no.
Reason?
He, you know, that's vastly overrated. Ronald Reagan handled press very well, and most of the times that he was accused of making a gaffe, it wasn't all that bad.
One of his more famous gaffes is when he said in response to the campaign to save the California redwoods, "A tree is a tree. How many more do you have to look at?"
Uh-huh.
And you write in your book that you, or I think it was your secretary, actually had the tape of him saying that, even though he later denied that he said it. But you never reminded him that he, in fact, really said it. Had he talked himself out of thinking that he'd said it?
Ronald Reagan has a wonderful quality of believing what he says. I would venture to say that Ronald Reagan doesn't think he's ever told a lie in his life, maybe one, because when he tells you something, he believes it, and that's a wonderful quality. Jesse Unruh, the old Democrat boss in California, told me once, he said, the difference between Reagan and the average politician is that when Reagan says something, he believes it so that the people listening to him believe it. But he said, when I tell a lie, I know I'm lying, and therefore so does everybody else.
You're right. Reagan was a macro manager and sometimes no manager at all. Ronald Reagan is no genius. In a way, I think you make him sound like a good figurehead for the people who were running the campaign or who were initiating the politics or putting forward the philosophy.
If I did that, if that's how you read that, I did him an injustice. The philosophy, I assure you, was his. The tough decisions were his. The ability to set the tone for the government, whether it was California or the United States, was his. But he was not a detail man. Like Jimmy Carter, he didn't worry about who played tennis on the White House tennis courts. He didn't worry about who his staff picked as their secretaries. He thought that that people who had been given jobs to do were qualified to do them, and he let them do them. And he didn't interfere, and sometimes once or twice it got him in trouble, such as Iran-Contra. But most of the time it served him very well.
One of George Bush's main men is James Baker, who yeah. is now running the campaign and would run the economic program if Bush is reelected. Now, I believe that Baker forced you out as political director
no,
12
that's,
years ago.
No, that's not true. When I came into the White House as assistant to the president for political affairs, I told them I would give them a year. I had initially had no intention of going into the White House. The fun of politics for me is the campaign and not government. So I gave them a year and 2 days, and I left, and there was no forcing out. I could have stayed indefinitely. No way Jim Baker could have forced me out of that White House.
You write about Baker in your book. Yeah. Jim Baker's best buddy is himself, James A. Baker III. The president runs a poor second, as he may eventually discover.
Yeah, I think that's a very accurate statement. I think that if Jim Baker really cared about his so-called best friend, George Bush, he'd have got into this campaign several months earlier. And once he got into it, he'd have not only taken charge, but he'd have stood up and been counted. And one of the interesting things about this campaign since Jim Baker got into it is it's hard to find hide nor hair of him. He's a friend of mine who's a bureau chief for a big newspaper told me a couple of weeks ago, he said, Jim Baker used to return my phone calls right away. He said, now even Margaret Tutwiler doesn't. And I think he's ducked because he's been afraid that George Bush would lose. No, he doesn't want to take the blame.
You brought a lot of people to Washington to work for the Reagan administration, and I'm sure many of those people are still there.
Yeah.
The word a couple of weeks ago was that a lot of Republicans were writing their resumes.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think a lot of those Republicans are tearing up those resumes now, thinking it won't be necessary?
Well, they're foolish if they are. Yeah, I mean, once you got them written, keep them and keep looking. Because, you know, I'll tell you, I think people can stay in government too long. I think that people who have been here in the administration since the Reagan years ought to get out and go home and get back in the private sector. Nobody promised them a lifetime job here. They came here because they believed in something, and too many of them are staying here now because it's an easy job, and I don't think that's any reason to stay here.
Lynn Nofziger has written a new memoir called Nofziger. This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Linda, are you following the latest polls?
Are you kidding? Of course we are. Terry, we've got Mara and Elizabeth, who both paused on their headlong dashes with the candidates. They happened to both be in Michigan when they called us. Andy Bowers has a piece on local television coverage and how the local press and the candidates relate. We also have an interview with a television station manager in California who has decided not to report the returns until California's polls have closed. She's going to ignore what the network is doing. We have a piece on AIDS and the three previous Republican administrations and letters from listeners.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. It's a rare day when one of the presidential candidates does not have a TV appearance scheduled. George Bush and Bill Clinton will be interviewed tonight on Primetime Live. Ross Perot declined to appear, then accepted, then declined. All three candidates are expected to be on a David Frost PBS special tomorrow night. TV critic David Bianculli says this has been some year for the electoral process and the media.
On Sunday, Ross Perot was on 60 Minutes, accusing the Bush campaign staff of blackmailing him into dropping out of the race. On Monday, Perot's live press briefing was on CNN, where he said he couldn't provide proof. On Tuesday, George Bush was on Today, calling the whole thing crazy. On Wednesday, Bill Clinton attacked Bush in very harsh terms on Today and Larry King Live. And already today, Bush has counterattacked Clinton on CBS This Morning. This saturation bombing of TV appearances is getting even heavier in these last days before the election. Perot was on Larry King Live tonight, and Bush gets equal time tomorrow night. Interest is so high out there in TV land that when interviewers can't get the candidates, they've begun to interview other interviewers. Today on Good Morning America, Charlie Gibson interviewed David Frost, who actually brought along a clip of his interview with Perot from tomorrow night's PBS special, like he was plugging a movie or something.
He's not talking now about whether he'll run, as some people think, in 96. And I asked him what his first line of his inaugural might be and so on. But I mean, he says he's going to win.
Well, we have that clip, I know, from the show. And as long as you've mentioned it, let's take a look at that clip from the program and from the interview. Ross Perot with David
Frost. So you're running to win?
Absolutely. Anybody that knows me would know that.
Right. And how many states...
Things have gotten so wild and crazy that the questions, as well as the people asking them and the shows on which they're being asked, are different this year. Here's Katie Couric on the NBC Today show yesterday, posing a question to Clinton.
Governor Clinton, since we were on the subject of Ross Perot, this is kind of a wacky question, but what the hey, it's been a wacky political year. This is from me. This week on Larry King, Cher, who apparently is helping to shape political discourse in the country along with everyone else, said that her idea of heaven would be a Clinton pledge to give Perot a top economic job. Do you foresee any place for Ross Perot in your administration if you're elected?
Well, you know, I've gone out of my way not to promise a position to anybody. I expect to have Republicans and independents in my administration along with Democrats. I want people with
the... The 1992 race has been different from the very beginning, and it's shifting almost daily. Perot has conducted most of his campaign under fairly controlled circumstances, official debates, and his own paid political infomercials. But now that he's gotten so much bad press after his 60 Minutes disclosure, Perot is ready and willing, though probably not eager, to sit still for the likes of David Frost. Clinton, who during most of the campaign covered all the ground from MTV and Arsenio to Donahue and Nightline, has cut back a bit lately. He's done enough to remain visible, but not so much that he has increased his chances of messing up. But as the race has tightened, Clinton will have to loosen up and get out even more. And Bush, who used to avoid confrontational interviews as a matter of policy, had little choice but to dive in and hope for the best. And even he had to be surprised and invigorated by how well he's been doing. Take, for example, an exchange he had Tuesday on the Today Show during a fairly tough session with Bryant Gumbel.
You know as well as I do, in baseball, when the team doesn't perform, you don't fire the whole team, you fire the manager.
That's right.
Why should the American people do otherwise?
Well, let's think of some other analogy.
Didn't like that one?
Well, how about Lasorda? He didn't have a particularly good year, but he's a damn good manager. Tommy Lasorda.
But they're not
he'll
firing the team there either.
Well, he'll be back, but the people will... There may be some changes on the team, but the manager will be back because he's earned the confidence of the... of the team and the people. And everyone knows he's a good manager. So how about that? And hey, fast thinking, Brian.
Not bad. Rightly.
TV critics, like politicians, spend a lot of time dumping on the media. But in this political year, the media deserve a lot of credit. TV learned its lesson in 1988, and it's worked all season to educate viewers about the politics behind the political images, the misrepresentations in the political ads, and the manipulations behind the photo opportunities. TV has worked hard to find a better way to stage TV debates, and people have watched them in record numbers. Finally, and most important, TV opened up the landscape and got candidates to appear on morning shows, primetime news magazines, cable talk shows, and everywhere in between. Politics on TV has never been like this before, but I've got news for you. It worked so well from the point of view of the candidates, the media, and especially the people, it'll always be this way again.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Post and author of Teleliteracy, Taking Television Seriously. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Joyce Lieberman and Audrey Voblaitis. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Kezia Perlman is our intern. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the George Gund Foundation. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, he's good enough, he's smart enough, and doggone it, people like him. He's Stuart Smalley, and he's addicted to 12-step programs. We'll talk with Al Franken, who created the character of Stuart Smalley, for Saturday Night Live. We'll also talk with Franken about covering the presidential campaign for the Comedy Channel. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.